From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a jazz concert. Singer Susanna McCorkle returns with a song about spring and some songs about love. Also today, we talk with two of the writers who decide if Gary gets killed or Ellen gets married. Winnie Holtzman and Richard Kramer write for 30-something. Critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Kitty Kelly's catty new biography of Nancy Reagan. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mr. Johnson, the tale of two men, one white, one black, in colonial Africa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. In Geneva today, Secretary of State James Baker said it is important to hold a conference on the future of the Middle East, despite disagreements on what form it should take. He was speaking at the end of his Middle East peace tour. Meeting with Syrian leaders earlier in the day, Baker noted that strong disagreement still exists on the shape of this future conference. The BBC's Christopher Powell has more.
The Secretary of State said that the substance of a Middle East peace conference was more important than its form, adding that it was not important what adjective went before the word conference. A clear reference to his disagreement with Syria and most other Arab states, which favor an international conference, which would presumably involve the Palestine Liberation Organization, to the regional one favored by the United States. But the main reason for Mr. Baker's visit was the refugee problem. And presented with an opportunity to be photographed with the heads of all the United Nations relief agencies, the World Health Organization, and the Red Cross, Mr. Baker was determined that the tragedy of the refugees who fled from Iraq should not be forgotten. Immediate aid was called for, he said, simply to save lives. This was a massive human tragedy and a situation which must not be permitted to continue.
The BBC's Christopher Powell reporting from Geneva. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has released the locations of 31 major military installations that he suggests should be closed. Cheney has also submitted plans for base closures at 12 minor installations and cutbacks at 28 other sites. He added that the cutbacks are needed since the American military will be about one-fourth smaller in 1995 than it is now. The secretary's proposal will now go to an independent 8-member panel, which can add or subtract sites from the list. Then President Bush will get the plan. He must either accept or reject the entire proposal. If he accepts it, then Congress will have the same choice. Israeli warplanes today attacked a radical Palestinian base in southern Lebanon, the 11th such raid since the beginning of the year. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
According to an Israeli military spokesman, the target was a terrorist base used as a launching point for raids against Israel. The spokesman said the base was 3 miles east of the port city of Sidon. The Israeli military spokesman did not identify the target of today's bombing raid, but reports from Lebanon say it was a guerrilla base belonging to the radical Palestinian Fatah Revolutionary Council led by Abu Nidal, a group which broke away from the PLO. Last month, Israeli warplanes blasted a Palestinian base manned by the Syrian-backed Ahmed Jibril Popular Front Group. The central Lebanese government, meanwhile, has ordered all armed groups in Lebanon to disarm in an attempt to end the 16-year-old civil war. Palestinian groups have vowed to keep their weapons. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow rose 15 points to close at 2920.79. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. EPA Administrator William Riley and five Republican governors today signed an agreement to prevent pollution in the Great Lakes. The plan calls on companies to voluntarily reduce the toxins they release into the air and water. NPR's Ira Glass reports from Chicago.
This plan for the Great Lakes isn't much different from a voluntary national program announced 2 months ago. But this time, EPA Administrator Riley had state governors agreeing to throw their political weight into the effort.
Our goal is the virtual elimination of persistent toxics in the lakes.
But environmentalists from the Greenpeace organization said there isn't much in the plan that would achieve that goal. It targets 17 chemicals, but doesn't target most of the important toxics polluting the Great Lakes. It's voluntary, and after 2 months, only a fourth of the companies contacted by the EPA have expressed an interest in complying. One environmentalist said the plan was more designed for sound bites in the 1992 presidential campaign than anything else. The three Democratic governors in Great Lakes states did not attend today's announcement. I'm Ira Glass in Chicago.
Worried engineers at NASA are going over data from the $1.5 billion Galileo Jupiter probe today. Preliminary reports show that its critical 16-foot main antenna may not have opened properly as it was supposed to yesterday. The failure of the antenna to open would be a major setback to the Galileo project, severely limiting the speed at which data about Jupiter can be transmitted back to Earth. A spokesman, however, at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, says scientists are hopeful about coaxing the antenna open. The Galileo was launched from the shuttle Atlantis in October 1989. It is scheduled to slip into orbit around Jupiter in 1995. The Commerce Department reported today that business inventories fell 0.2% in February and sales grew 0.5%. The figure is 2.5% above the figure for February 1 year ago. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I know I've mentioned before on the show that one of my favorite singers is Susanna McCorkle. Now, it's been a couple of years since she's performed on Fresh Air, and that seemed like too long, so we asked her to please come back. A lot has happened since her last Fresh Air performance. She now has a couple of records on Concord Jazz, No More Blues, and an album of Brazilian songs called Sabia. Earlier this year, she performed in the Oak Room of the Algonquin Hotel, which is one of New York's top rooms for cabaret singers. And in a New York Times review of her performance, Stephen Holden said, "Her gorgeous, sultry singing transports the listener to places that elude description." Playing with Susanna today is Ben Aronov on piano, John Goldsby on bass, and I want to welcome all of you to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. It's great to be back.
Great to have you back. Susanna, what do you want to open with?
Well, I'd like to do a George and Ira Gershwin song, and I just found the verse after the last recession, actually, the 87 October one. I found this old verse, which was so relevant. And, of course, life does go in cycles. We all have to remember that. So I'm throwing in the verse, which seems as if it had been written for us now.
Who cares if the sky in the sea? Who cares how history rates me? Long as your kiss intoxicates me, why should I? A million firms go under. I am not concerned with stocks and bonds that I've been burned with. I love you and you love me, and that's how it will always be, and nothing else could ever mean a thing. Who cares what the public chatters? Love is all that matters. Who cares if the sky see? Who cares if banks fail in Yonkers? Long as you've got the kiss that conquers, why should I
great. My guest is Susanna McCorkle. Susanna, that sounds terrific.
Oh, thanks.
You know, you have an album of Brazilian songs, and you've actually done the translations from Portuguese to English for some of the songs. I'd like to ask you to do one of them and to tell us a little bit about how you translated it. How do you know Portuguese?
Sure. Well, I studied languages. I almost became an interpreter for the common market, but chose the more secure career of singer instead.
Right.
And I always was fascinated by languages from the time I could understand that there were separate languages and that nonsense words in one language made perfect sense in another. And I started studying, I think, French first in sixth or seventh grade. I really and loved to learn songs. And when I studied Portuguese, I was in Rome working as an interpreter and translator, and the Brazilian embassy was offering some classes. So I wanted Brazilian Portuguese, especially because it's Brazilian songs that I really love. And since I'd studied Romance languages before, French, Italian, and Spanish, it's, of course, very closely related, although the pronunciation is very different. And I really loved the songs so much that I wanted to sing them in the original language, sort of the way we love seeing foreign films in subtitles. You know, you just want to see the actors singing in their own, speaking in their own languages. And Brazilian songs really deserve to be in their own language. But I also felt when I sang them that audiences didn't respond to them the way I hoped they would when I sang only in Portuguese, even if I translated first and then sang. People need to be involved and know what's going on. So many songs, good songs, weren't translated at all into English or had very banal kind of Tin Pan Alley translations that had nothing to do with the original, that when I set about making an album all of Brazilian songs, I decided that I would try to bring to a wider audience some of the songs that I thought were especially beautiful.
So have you tried to stick really close to the original Portuguese lyrics in your English translation?
I have wherever possible. In this song, I expanded a little because, you know, not every single song has fabulous lyrics. This one was more a cute song, which I heard Bola Sete, a great Brazilian guitarist, record. He recorded it and he sang it. He didn't sing very often, but I loved his throwaway, nonchalant style. So, but I found that the lyric just didn't say quite enough in Portuguese, although the kernel of an idea was there. So I expanded on what I thought the writer was saying. And it's called Dilema in both Portuguese and English. And it's about, my translation is about a very common situation, which is having been friends for a long, long time with someone and always enjoying each other, keeping in touch over the years, and then suddenly realizing that you, at least, have fallen in love. And that's your dilemma. What do you do now? Do you shut up or do you confess your love? You know, do you lose the friendship or do you get a great, wonderful love affair? And it's a risk you take. So this song is about that moment of making the decision before you make it.
Why don't you sing it?
Sure.
Perceber. Muitas coisas eu diria, mas não tive a ousadia. Minha voz emudeceu. Eu já tenho um pensamento, como vou me declarar? Mas na hora que tormento, tá de boca pra falar. Eu tentei dizer somente, com os olhos meu querer. Mas aí os olhos dele, não tem jeito de entender. E esse é o meu dilema, minha mágoa, minha dor. Ou ele vê nos meus olhos, ou eu fico sem amor. I'm in such a bad dilemma, and I don't know what to do. I'm in love with someone, but I don't know if he could ever love me too. I don't know if he could ever love me too. He's the one I always dream of, but he thinks I'm just a friend. And if I suddenly say I love you, it may be the beginning, it may be the end. We've been playing games and laughing since he was five and I was four. But after all that laughter, I look at him and I want so much more. Oh, it's such a sad dilemma, and I wish I knew the end. If I tell him, will I find a great love or will I lose an old friend? Playing games and laughing since he was five and I was four. But after all that laughter, I look at him and I want so much more. Oh, it's such a sad dilemma, and I wish I knew the end. If I tell him, will I find a great love or will I lose an old friend? If I tell him, will I find a great love or will I lose an old friend? It may be the beginning, it may be the end. It may be the beginning, it may be the end. It may be the beginning, it may be the end. It may be the beginning. The end, the end, the end, the end.
great. I really like the English lyric that you wrote. Susanna, how about a song about spring?
Well, I do have a group of spring songs that I like to haul out every spring, but I noticed that most of them are very, very sad, you know, so this is my favorite of the sad ones. It's by Rodgers and Hart. Once there was a thing called spring, when the world was writing verses like yours and mine. All the lads and girls would sing as they sat at little tables and drank May wine. Now April, May, and June are sadly out of tune. Life has stuck a pin in the balloon.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. Oh, it makes me sad to say that's a good song.
Do you get really involved with the emotions that you're seeing?
I do. really get moved by the good songs every time, as I never get tired of singing them.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll hear some more music by Susanna McCorkle. We're featuring a concert today on Fresh Air. We'll hear more of it in just a few seconds after this break. This is Fresh Air. Featuring a concert today with Susanna McCorkle, and performing with her is Ben Aronov at the piano and John Goldsby on bass. And I should mention, you know, if you're enjoying Susanna's music, she has a couple of records on Concord Records, No More Blues, and an album of Portuguese songs called Sabia. I should ask you to sing something upbeat since the past song put you into a sad mood.
Yes, okay. Well, how about Cole Porter? He's always great for laughs, his funniest songs.
Sure.
This is when... called Let's Do It, which Noel Coward wrote a parody of, which is also very funny, but I don't think can be broadcast across the United States. But we'll stick with Cole Porter's, which is so clever. There's a whole chorus about, I don't have time to do them all, but there's one about insects and one about fish and one all about animals and one all about humans, and he's wonderfully witty.
When the little blue bird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring. When the little blue bell at the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work croons a tune to the moon up above. It's nature, that's all. Simply telling us to fall in love. The chimpanzees in the zoos do it. Some courageous kangaroos do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. I'm sure giraffes on the slide do it. Hippopotami do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Old sloths who hang down from twigs do it, though the effort is great. Sweet guinea pigs do it. Buy a couple and wait. The world admits bears in pits do it. Even Pekingeses at the Ritz do it. Let's do it. Let's do it. The nightingales in the dark do it. Lark's crazy for a lark do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Canaries caged in the house do it. Supposed to be wise. Penguins in flocks on the rocks do it. Even little cuckoos in their clocks do it. Let's do it. Let's do it. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it. Not to mention the Finns. Folks in of Siamese twins. Some Argentines without means do it. People say in Boston even beans do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
remember the first time you heard the song?
Let's Do It?
Yeah. It's one of those songs that's always around.
I know. And then, I can't remember. But I realized something interesting about it when I decided to do my arrangement. You know, we're all used to hearing birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. And that's actually the end of the chorus about insects. And it was moved to the beginning of the chorus because it started with chinks do it, Japs do it, up in Lapland, little Laps do it, which, of course, no one would ever sing anymore. And I found that was interesting to me historically, that one time it was perfectly acceptable to start off the song singing that way. And I didn't want to, you know, so I cut the humans down to half a chorus. And, you know, it amazes me what you find out when you go back to songs. I mean, they reflected our times. But they did. I think song lyrics changed to fit changing times or were dropped faster than movies did or something. It's very interesting to me. I don't know if it is to you, but...
oh, yeah, well, you know, I used to find...
Or if you even want to talk about that on the air, but...
Well, back when I used to play a lot of records on the air, I used to find that there were some songs I used to really love, but they'd have these verses that were
about
kind of offensive.
Or
yeah, like,
yes.
like Mississippi Mud, you know, when the darkies beat their feet on the Mississippi Mud. Yeah, but it's a great record, and it's a great song outside of that one line
in
the lyric.
And it's amazing that people just thought that was fine at one time to us now. You know, but it has to be acknowledged.
Are there songs that you love but that you don't think are for you as a singer and you couldn't really perform them?
Oh, sure.
What kind of songs would fit in that category?
Well, Stephen Sondheim's song, I'm Still Here. I love that, but you've got to have a real, you know...
Big brassy.
Beat up old broad, you know, cynical. And as someone, I think People magazine said, I was a bruised romantic, and I just don't have the right voice. My outlook is really too optimistic for that. I mean, I have my share of depression, but I don't really feel like an old battle axe who survived everything, you know. And things like All the Things You Are, it's beautiful, but I just don't have anything fresh to add to it, and I don't have a piece of my life to give to it. So there are many, many songs like that. I'm always thinking, oh, I wish I could do that song, but it's not for me. No.
It was a tremendous pleasure to have you on the show
today.
Oh, it's
always
great
to see you and to be here.
It is great to have you here. And I want to thank you. And I want to thank the musicians for performing as well. Ben Aronoff on the piano and John Goldsby on bass. And I want to recommend you to some of Susanna's records if you want to hear her more on record. She has two records on Concord Jazz. One is called No More Blues. And the other is an album of Brazilian songs called Sabia. And also, if you live in St. Paul, Susanna's coming out your way to sing at the Dakota Bar and Grill next week. She'll also be in Salina and Topeka, Kansas. And the week after that, she'll be in Oakland at Yoshi's. Let me ask you to sing us out.
Sure. This is an up-tempo song that I've been doing to feature the musicians because I love to have them play solos. And it's an old standard made famous and beloved by Les Paul and Mary Ford originally. Sun is shining, no more pining, just we two, smiling through. Don't sigh, don't cry, bye-bye blues.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. They're young, they're good-looking, they do okay financially. So why do all the characters on 30-something have so many problems? Coming up, we talk with two of the show's writers, Richard Kramer and Winnie Holtzman. Right now, Nancy Reagan's problem has got to be Kitty Kelly's scathing new biography. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mr. Johnson. It's the new movie from Bruce Beresford, who won last year's Best Picture Oscar for Driving Miss Daisy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney has announced a list of 31 military bases that the Pentagon wants to close over the next 5 years. NPR's Neil Conan reports from the Pentagon.
Fort Ord in California, Fort Dix, New Jersey, Fort Benjamin Harris in Indiana. Secretary Cheney said that each of the 31 bases is hard to cut, but that sharp reductions in the Pentagon budget leave him no option. U.S. forces will be 25% smaller in 5 years, and smaller forces need fewer bases. The secretary claimed that there was no partisan bias on his list, that bases in Democratic districts were not singled out. Cheney said he accepted the recommendations of his military service chiefs in every case except one, and that was a procedural problem with Congress rather than a disagreement. On Monday, his proposals go to a new 8-member base closing commission, which, after taking public testimony, will make its recommendation to the White House. The president has one chance to suggest revisions, then the whole package goes to Congress, which must vote on it as a package, all or nothing. This is Neil Conan at the Pentagon.
U.S. officials say that transport helicopters are being sent to Turkey to help in relief operations there for Kurdish refugees. These reinforcements will almost double the number of U.S. military personnel involved in the operations in Turkey to more than 8,000. Secretary of State James Baker has wrapped up his latest round of Middle Eastern diplomacy, meeting today in Geneva with the foreign minister of Jordan. This meeting represents the resumption of high-level contacts between Jordan and the U.S. Relations between the two nations were strained because of Jordan's support for Iraq during the Persian Gulf War. Now the two countries appear to be in agreement on the idea of a regional peace conference. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Amman.
The idea of a regional peace conference was proposed by Israel and the United States, and it's won the tentative backing of Egypt and Saudi Arabia. The Syrians have not ruled out the idea of a conference, but they're insisting that the United Nations play a significant role. The Jordanians, for whom solving the Palestinian problem is a higher priority than any other country in the Middle East right now, also reacted positively to the latest proposal. Jordan shares a long border with the Israeli-occupied territories, and its population is more than 50% Palestinian. The Jordanian foreign minister said that his country would attend a peace conference. What kind of conference, he said, was less important than what the conference addressed. The Jordanians want Israel to agree to the principle of trading land for peace, something Israel has so far refused to do. Jordan also agreed to be part of a joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation at the talks, as long as the Palestinians agreed. In Amman, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 15 points to close at 2,920.79 on volume of 199 million shares. Advancing issues led declines 3-2. This is NPR News. According to officials in Warsaw, Poland wants to sell at least 4 million metric tons of food to the Soviet Union. Now, with a food surplus, Poland is apparently ready to go beyond an offer of 1 million tons of grain and 100,000 tons of meat promised to Moscow. Grain silos in Poland are full with last year's crop, and the government is concerned that unless it is sold, farmers will not be able to export this year's harvest. Government measures introduced a year and a half ago, taking away subsidies and cutting incomes, have raised food prices in Poland and lowered demand. In South Africa, the African National Congress has announced proposals for a new constitution. NPR's John Madison reports that it's a plan calling for a colorblind democratic state.
It's basically a Western constitution with strong American influences. There are two houses of parliament, a Senate and a National Assembly, an elected president who can serve a maximum of 2 5-year terms, and a Bill of Rights which would protect people against the practice of apartheid. The ANC says this is a draft and it's open to discussion, but it now wants to see the government's proposal. The government has not yet said publicly what kind of constitution it wants, but it apparently plans to have some form of protection for the white minority that it represents. A multi-party conference is planned later this year at which it will discuss the mechanisms for the transition to democracy. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
In Washington, federal officials said today that liver transplants may now be paid for by Medicare. Officials say these transplants will be covered at facilities that have experience and good survival rates and will be allowed for patients with a critical need and a maximum likelihood of recovery. This new coverage is expected to cost the federal health program $25 million this fiscal year, $55 million next year, $85 million in 1993. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Everybody's talking about the new unauthorized biography of former First Lady Nancy Reagan. Commentator Maureen Corrigan has actually read it cover to cover and has these thoughts.
If only Nancy Reagan had been nicer to American feminists. If she had endorsed the ERA, if she had acknowledged her early career as an ambitious starlet instead of insisting that her life began the day she met Ronnie. If she had spoken up about her pro-choice leanings, maybe then feminists like me would be defending her against Kitty Kelly's nasty accusations. We might have claimed that Nancy was just a victim of the patriarchally constructed role of First Lady, that she was only trying to fulfill the sexist demands of that role when she helped herself to millions of dollars worth of designer clothes. We might have applauded Nancy's decision to assert her autonomy in her alleged affair with Frank Sinatra and in her schemes to seize presidential power while her husband napped. But Nancy never once used that power to further women's causes. So I'm not about to rescue her through the revisionary magic of feminist criticism, which has lately made heroines of Lady Macbeth and Catherine the Great. I'd rather defend Kitty Kelly's biography of her. I lapped up every page of it with catty glee. Critics are complaining about Kelly's slick writing style. Instead of a footnoted narrative of Nancy's life, Kelly strings together over 500 pages of loosely attributed anecdotes. But I figure that even if only a fraction of the dirt that Kelly dishes is true, Nancy still emerges here as a real-life incarnation of the witch queen, Aisha, the villainess of H. Rider Haggard's Victorian novel, She. The title is short for She Who Must Be Obeyed. Here are some blood-curdling Nancy highlights. As a teenager, Nancy disowned her real father, a salesman, and got herself adopted by her mother's second husband, a society surgeon. According to one of Kelly's sources, Nancy was a girl whose phone number got passed around. The rumor is that Nancy slept her way into an MGM contract. Kelly claims that after Nancy lured the hapless Ronnie into marriage by becoming pregnant, she all but banished his two children by Jane Wyman. Nancy even supposedly used her clout to try to get stepson Michael shipped off to Vietnam. One of the most chilling anecdotes was told by a Look magazine photographer who alleged that Nancy can hold a full-toothed, flash-frozen smile longer than anyone I've ever seen. He said, "I photographed Nancy on a hospital visit where she hugged a little kid for so long that the kid got squirmy and peed all over her shoes. But Nancy wouldn't let go. She never stopped smiling until I stopped clicking." Some critics say that Kelly's portrait of Nancy is too negative, as though the truth about a person's life is always balanced in the moral center. Face it, some people are just rotten. But unlike a Hitler or a Picasso, Nancy's evil ways don't merit a place in history because of either diabolical or artistic genius. She was just a petty tyrant who helped to sustain an apparently hypocritical national illusion for 8 years. So watching Kelly strip away Nancy's gleaming facade is perversely entertaining, like coming to the end of Haggard's novel and seeing the witch queen Aisha, she who must be obeyed, dissolve before our eyes into a pile of corrupt ashes.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Kitty Kelly's new biography of Nancy Reagan. This is Fresh Air. 30-something seems to be the kind of program that elicits very ambivalent responses. That ambivalence was best summed up by our TV critic, David Bianculli, when he said there's no other show he likes less that he watches more. On the other hand, a lot of people watch 30-something because they think it describes the day-to-day ups and downs of life better than anything else on TV. Last Tuesday, the show returned from a hiatus, and Ellen got married. On the next show, one of the minor characters will find out he tests positive for the HIV virus. This episode was co-written by my guest Richard Kramer, who's been with the show from the start and is now a producer. My other guest, Winnie Holtzman, wrote the recent episodes about Melissa's gallery opening and the bachelor parties for Ellen and Billy. Shows by Kramer and Holtzman are included in a new book of scripts from 30-something called 30-something Stories. Some TV shows have what they call a Bible, which describes the style, structure, and feel of the show. I asked Holtzman if she was given a Bible when she joined the writing staff.
We don't have a Bible, per se, on 30-something. This is sort of stored in Marshall and Ed's brain in the sense of where they're planning to take the show. And everyone kind of who needs to know about that knows about it. When I was first assigned, yes, I was given an episode, meaning, you know, we want Polly to have this affair. We want Ellen to have this affair with a married man, and we want her to get, you know, in over her head. And that was how it started. And then from that came many, many conversations, which I participated in. So,
Were there any guidelines you were given about, you know, how many plots you had to work into one episode, or how much can happen to one character in an episode? Are there certain rules of thumb that, you know, the writers are expected to follow to make episodes conform with each other in terms of feel or sensibility?
Can I answer that one?
Sure.
I think that we regard the episodic form, really as like that of a short story, and that the emotional ground that it covers in the space of the 46-minute hour, which is what one of our episodes runs, tracks a fundamental change in attitude that the main character undergoes, that you see them believing something very deeply at the beginning of a show, and then by the end, that attitude has been thrown into question and is just at the point where it is starting to change. And, you know, our stories really tend, ultimately, even ones that have subplots, to focus on one person and to follow that one person's change in how they view the world.
Winnie, let me ask you to describe the episode that you've had reprinted in the 30-something Stories book and why you chose that episode.
Gary and Susanna are having some money problems, are feeling a pinch at the same time that Michael and Hope are prospering. And basically the episode is about what this does to their respective relationships. And specifically, it was really about Gary feeling less than his friend and having to cope with that and what that does to a friendship.
Now, is that a storyline you were assigned or one that you came up with?
Well, you see, it's interesting. Again, I was assigned it and I came up with it. If you can try to picture the way we do things, you might be given a sentence. You might have Marshall and Ed say, "We want Gary to have money problems. We want Gary and Michael to have problems about money." That's one sentence. From there, a whole show's going to spring. And I would have many, many conversations. I mean, I would have 3 or 4 Marshall and Ed conversations that I would participate in before I would set down pen to paper.
What about talking with the actors on the show? Do you talk with them when you're doing a script, too?
No, I don't.
Afterwards is when they tend to have the most to say. You know, we will finish a draft of a script, and then once they read it, they tend to become excited and interested and have their own feedback. Our particular cast is extremely articulate, for the most part trained in the theater, able to break down and interpret a script. And we have really, you know, I think benefited from that.
Richard, let me ask you to describe the episode that you have reprinted in the book.
Oh, sure. excuse me. That episode is follows two stories. It follows the story of Melissa and her younger boyfriend, Lee, and Melissa's friend, Russell, and a relationship he has with a man who works in Michael's office. And the stories are really parallel experiences for the two couples because they both deal with in this case, Melissa's and Russell's internalized self-judgment and how they use that to prevent themselves from making connections in the world.
There's a scene where Russell and Peter are in bed together.
Yes.
And what you have written in the script as the stage direction is they move closer into each other's arms. So how much do you see of that, and when did the camera cut? I mean, what kinds of discussions were there about what you'd be allowed to show on television in that
scene? There were no discussions. I mean, it was just we were dealt with, you know, by the network, by the actors, by everybody, as if we were mature, responsible adults. Nobody ever once on 30-something has said, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do. They trust us as creative people. That's why we are given the mandate to do the show.
There are no censors anymore or standards and practices?
There are standards and practices, people. They tend to function mostly around questions of language. And, you know, you just internalize what words you can and cannot say. I wonder what you think about this, Winnie, but I don't find the standards and practices notes particularly irksome. I find them more comic.
For me, it hasn't really been a problem. It's been more of a challenge to find other ways to say what you can't say on TV.
Richard, you said you found the standards and practices notes more comic than anything else. Can you give an example of specific notes that you thought were pretty funny, unintentionally funny?
Yes. The show was quite frank about issues of sex and sexuality. And there was a scene where Melissa was describing what it was like to be in bed with Lee, her younger lover, to Hope. And I wanted her to reach a point of inarticulacy that the two women would understand and not have to be explicated beyond that point. And the line that I wrote for Melanie Mayron to give was something like this. It was, and when I'm with him and he's inside me, and then I had a trailing off with three dots and was going to let Hope and correspondingly the audience fill in the blanks. And this became a subject of enormous worry to the standards and practices people because it implied that they were actually sleeping together. And their suggestion to lessen their pain was that the line be changed or looped, which is a word added after you shoot, to when I'm with him and he's inside my apartment.
Yeah, that doesn't quite get it, does it?
Not quite the
same
thing.
It's a little different.
Well, how did you resolve that one?
We won.
Did you really?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what kind of argument did you make in support of the language you wanted to use?
We just said, leave us alone. And then, you know, it's censorship in television, it's a complex negotiation. You know what you want to fight for, and you know what's less important to fight for. We wanted to establish in that show, as in the series as a whole, a general maturity and level of frankness when talking about issues like this. And, you know, we had the precedent of doing that, and that's what we were able to stand on.
I want to get back to something we were talking about before, which is the episode about Russell and Peter.
Now,
I had read that this episode was, some sponsors were upset by it. Is that right?
Yeah, it's correct.
What was their response?
These sponsors were reacting to the pressure of certain fundamentalist organized viewer watchdog groups who have a highly organized mailing list that inundates the people on their mailing list with lists of television shows and films that they find unacceptable for their membership. These people are then asked to write to advertisers who sponsor these shows saying that they were offended morally and that they will withdraw their support for their product. Advertisers seem to be very sensitive to this, and the Strangers episode of 30-something was a perfect example of presenting a way of living that was not acceptable to these people.
When viewers wrote to the sponsors, what was the sponsor's reaction to the show? Did the sponsors feel very threatened?
Certain sponsors withdrew their support.
Since viewers couldn't respond to the show till after it was broadcast, what did the sponsors withdraw from? Other episodes?
They withdrew from rerunning it. What the press does not report is that when they say we are inundated with negative letters, we are much more inundated with positive letters. I mean, I would say that the number of letters that were positive about strangers and other shows on other subjects we have done is at least 10 to 1. And the press does not report that. And I believe that that perpetuates a prejudice that you cannot deal with mature, adult, humanistic programming on primetime television because certain people are going to say, we don't want to see it. Many people do want to see it. They just are not as well organized in making themselves known to the media.
You know, to some people, the show 30-something signifies baby boom middle class self-absorption. You know, the word 30-something has almost become shorthand for a certain kind of self-absorption among people who don't like the show. How does that make you feel?
I think we've stopped defending ourselves. You know, I mean, our attitude right now is if they don't get it, there's other things on television to watch. We have never accepted or believed what our critics said about us because we're human. You know, I mean, we have never felt that we were whining, self-absorbed, a ripoff of The Big Chill. We were just writing about these seven people in this, you know, in Philadelphia who were having these problems and some days were better than others. And we were reflecting, to some degree, our own experience. I think a careful viewing of the show will show that they are not obsessed with material things, that they share a common purpose in life, which is how to live decently in a difficult world.
The show started in 1986 or 87?
87.
87. And that means that the characters are about 4 years older than they were when it started. Yeah. Are some of them turning 40? Is this the kind of thing that concerns you, that they'll be 40-something soon?
Well, you have to remember that television time is different than real time.
I know. Like kids say in high school, in the high school series, for decades.
I know. Well, see, in our minds, we're still back in 1987. So they are 30-something forever.
Thank you both very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Richard Kramer and Winnie Holtzman write for the TV show 30-something. Their work is included in a new book of scripts from the show called 30-something Stories. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we have news of the base closings announced by Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney. Also, a report on the National Rifle Association and how it's handling the challenge to its power on Capitol Hill in the form of the Brady Bill that might yet be passed and signed. We'll also be hearing about New York Times sports columnist Robert Lipsyte, who's back writing a column at the paper for the first time in 20 years. And a talk with the president of the newly declared independent Republic of Georgia in the Soviet Union, Zviad Gamzahordia.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After Bruce Beresford's film Driving Miss Daisy won last year's Oscar for Best Picture, he could have chosen a big Hollywood project for his next film, but instead he chose to direct a small movie set in Africa. Stephen Schiff has a review of Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson whisks us off to Nigeria in the 30s, to a stark rural outpost just barely colonized by the British. Seen through Western eyes, it's a wild place, and the director, Bruce Beresford, brings out the wildness in it. There are ceremonial parades in which hyenas snarl from leashes, and the marching villagers blow weird, noisy horns. When the locals dance and sing, it's always a little stranger and more extreme than we expect. Beresford wants us to see that, faced with the impossibility of understanding this culture, the British can only try to control it. This movie takes place in a world that's very remote, and the smartest man there, and by far the most imaginative, is Mr. Johnson himself. The trouble is, he's a Nigerian, and so the most he can hope for in this life is to be a functionary, highly regarded by the British district officer or his superiors. In ordinary times, there might be nothing in Johnson's existence tantalizing enough to engage his powerful imagination. But in colonial times, there is something. He can imagine Englishness, and so he does. He speaks of himself as an Englishman, and he tells his fellow villagers about how we do things back in Cornwall and Kent, even though they know he's never been there. He wears a British pith helmet and an ice cream suit, and he works for the Brits, first for the dim district officer Rudbeck, played surprisingly well by Pierce Brosnan, and then for the sadistic sergeant who runs the local store, wonderfully played by Edward Woodward. Mr. Johnson is the story of a man whose imagination outruns his circumstances. In the West, he'd be an artist, or a business tycoon, or a politician. But here in Africa, his boundless talents can only get him into trouble, which they do. For instance, he wants to help District Officer Rudbeck build a road, but there's no money to pay the tribesmen to work on it. So Johnson goes to the villages and exhorts their help, promising them free beer now and greater riches later. His speech doesn't work. That's when he sits down with the village chief for a little powwow.
No one wants to work. It's a shame. Then there is no chance to win the prize. Prize? What is this prize? The village which cares the most bush gets the prize. £5. £5? Who gets it? It is paid to the chief. Oh.
Of course, Mr. Johnson has just made up that little scheme on the spot. He has no idea where he'll get the money. He only knows he'll think of something, and alas, he does. Maynard Ezeyashi, who plays Johnson, is a Nigerian actor educated in England, and his performance is a wonder. He makes you see that what fuels Johnson is the way he can convert any obstacle or hardship into part of his big dream. He swallows life whole and worries about digesting it later. The director, Bruce Beresford, has become a master at taking messagey, sentimental material and removing the syrup. And he's terrific with actors. The performances he gets from a marvelous cast of Nigerians are breathtaking. A few critics have taken this movie to task because it can't match the ironies of its source material, a novel by the great Joyce Carey, and it's true, it can't. But Mr. Johnson is an accomplishment in its own right. At the movies these days, subtle pleasures can feel like very great pleasures indeed.
Film critic Stephen Schiff writes for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tuohy. Research assistance from Ellen Silva and Tracy Hildebrandt. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As a child in Vietnam, Pham Thanh was nearly killed when Americans attacked his village. But he was taken to America to recover and was adopted by an American foster family. On the next Fresh Air, Tan discusses his complicated emotions about America, and we meet Elizabeth Farnsworth, who made a documentary about him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.